My guest at this time is Gail Trotter. She's an attorney and partner in the law firm of Schaefer and Trotter. She's a senior fellow at the Independent Women's Forum, and she is a columnist for a number of publications. She had one today in the Washington Times saying how the King versus Burwell case, which had oral arguments before the Supreme Court on Wednesday, amounts to a potential do-over for Chief Justice John Roberts. And Gail, thanks very much for being with us.
Great to be with you.
Your column kind of contrasted first the do-over for the president's oath of office when Roberts kind of bungled that and Obama bungled in repeating after him back in 2009, and kind of paralleled it to the fact that this is the court's second crack at Obamacare. King versus Burwell, for those who don't know, focuses on whether or not there is legally a federal exchange for consumers to find subsidies to help pay for their health care premiums, since the vast majority of states refuse to set up their own exchanges. Why do you see this parallel, this do-over potential here?
Yes, when I was reflecting on this historic case that the Supreme Court heard oral arguments about today, it reminded me of the last time Chief Justice Roberts and President Obama came together in the original Obamacare case, which made me think about the first time that they really came together at the inauguration of President Obama for his first term, when he stepped up to the platform and you had the perfect president-elect, Barack Obama, who was the first African-American president of the Harvard Law Review. He was plauded by all sorts of media types. They thought he was the greatest orator of his generation. Barbara Walters even called him the next Messiah. And when you thought about that in relation to Chief Justice Roberts, he likewise had a list of accomplishments on his resume that could choke a horse. He was the youngest Chief Justice since John Marshall. He had top honors at Harvard College and Harvard Law School. So when the perfect president-elect and the perfect Chief Justice stepped up to the platform on that fateful inauguration day and recited this very easy oath of office, the words of which are contained in our Constitution, everyone thought that it would be a picture-perfect inauguration, and yet it was the flub heard round the world. And I thought of that in relation to the first Obamacare decision when Chief Justice Roberts went against what logic would dictate, what everyone thought that he would decide on that case, and he upheld Obamacare, torturing the logic behind it to find it a tax. And I thought, this is a chance for a constitutional do-over in this case that the Supreme Court is hearing now, just like President Obama and Justice Roberts had to do a do-over of the oath of office after it was flubbed in the first instance.
At issue, of course, as we mentioned earlier, are the words exchanges established by the state. The Obama administration arguing that obviously there can be a federal exchange if 30-some states aren't going to provide one of their own. There's obviously been different rulings at the federal appellate court level as well. For the right, this seems cut and dried. For the left, they say, well, it's pretty clear what was intended here. As you listen to the arguments today, which one seems stronger to you?
Clearly, the stronger argument is to stick to the black letter of the law. That's why we have laws. So we have a rule of law, so we can look at the text of the law, we can all understand it and agree. And the language is very clear. The subsidies only occur when the state establishes the health care exchange, not when the federal government establishes a health care exchange. So for those states where the governors and the legislatures decided not to set up the exchanges, the citizens in those states should not be forced to have the individual mandate, and they should not be entitled to the subsidies because their representatives decided that the costs of Obamacare outweighed the small benefits that the federal government was providing for a limited amount of time.
And we're talking with Gail Trotter of the Independent Women's Forum. She's also a lawyer and a columnist. It's always difficult and always risky to kind of read the minds of justices during the oral arguments. That's certainly one of the lessons many people learned from the first go-around on Obamacare, but most of the folks today looking at this said the four liberal justices seem pretty much in line with the administration's argument. Justices Scalia and Alito seem to be openly sympathetic to the plaintiffs in this case. Justice Thomas, as usual, staying fairly quiet on this, but it's assumed that he's probably going to go towards the plaintiffs on this. Justice Kennedy, often the swing vote, His big question on this, Gail, was did states know that when they were making the decision about whether to set up the exchanges, that the law suggested that if they don't do it, people wouldn't get subsidies? Of course, the government is arguing that they assumed that the federal government would pick that up, so that was not part of their calculation. What do you make of that being one of the key points made by Justice Kennedy, and how well was it addressed?
Yes, the government's lawyers were certainly trying to make the argument to Justice Kennedy that this was a federalism issue, that the federal government can't use a cudgel to make the states set up these exchanges to basically pass a law and push it on the states. And they're trying to kind of play into what they think his judicial philosophy is. But the truth is, and this has been acknowledged, that if you look at the letter of the law and you look at, for example, Jonathan Gruber, who is widely known as the architect, the brains behind Obamacare, he said over and over again that the reason the law was designed the way it was specifically so that it was intended to force the state to set up these health care exchanges, and you have it from the horse's mouth himself. And so it's really going to come down to whether Justice Kennedy accepts the plaintiff's arguments or if he's subject to this kind of post hoc rationalization by advocates of Obamacare who were trying to use this to force the states to do what they wanted. But now that argument has been made by the plaintiffs that could possibly bring down a lot of the what the left thinks are the advantages of Obamacare, but really are limiting of choices and denigrating our health care system, it comes down to which arguments Justice Kennedy thinks are more persuasive.
The other thing folks noted today, Gail, was that usually Chief Justice Roberts is very much active in the back and forth in the oral arguments. Today, he hardly said a word. Anything you would read into that?
Yes, and this has been something that has been very much discussed. It was thought that Justice Roberts, especially from the text of the majority opinion he issued in the first Obamacare case, the beginning of it started out that Obamacare was unconstitutional. It violated the Commerce Clause. So much so that original readings and reports by major news organizations said that Obamacare had been overturned. But as you continued to read through the opinion, Justice Roberts basically turned it on its head and said that because it was through the taxing power, then Congress had the right to make Obamacare. So I think because of that and the pressure, significant pressure that has been put on by all sorts of elite academics and media folks on John Roberts that they think was successful in the first go-round of this Obamacare fight, I think he's holding his cards very close to his chest. You may remember, too, President Obama lectured the Supreme Court and said, I can't believe that the Supreme Court would overturn a law that was passed by a significant majority of the Congress, which was not true. It was not a significant majority of the Congress. But there were many times where President Obama tried to use the bully pulpit to bully the Supreme Court. And I think that's why John Roberts is staying quiet, because he is really trying to make up his mind of how he's going to decide this case.
Gail, just a couple minutes left in our conversation here, and an interesting position for opponents of Obamacare. If, in fact, the court ultimately sides with the plaintiffs in this case and strikes down the federal exchange, at least, you've got some folks who believe that at that point, Obamacare would collapse under its own weight, which is something that opponents have been wanting ever since it was first proposed. But it does put opponents in an interesting position. On the one hand, you have folks up on the Capitol Hill, particularly Senate Republicans, with a plan in place to have an alternative for folks, which would certainly have other opponents upset that they're essentially saving Obamacare. But if they do nothing, it appears that you're hanging the American people out to dry and foisting huge premiums on them with no help from the subsidies. So how do they navigate that?
This is an extremely unpopular law. So Americans, and not the elite in Washington, D.C., are going to be happy if Obamacare collapses under its own weight, because they've seen the rising premiums. They've seen the limitations of access to the doctors that they want to choose. They've seen the choices that they have not been able to make based on the types of health care that they previously had. I mean, we all remember you can keep your plan if you like your plan, and that was a disastrous lie. So the law is unpopular. Congress must act. Congress has all the backing it needs to repeal and replace Obamacare. There are many great ideas out there. Congress needs to come together, come up with the best patient protection type of legislation that increases free market options and makes sure that the power of the doctor-patient relationship is respected. So it would be a great opportunity if the Supreme Court were to rule in favor of the petitioners and allow Congress to go back to the beginning and make legislation, make a law that helps with healthcare choices in a way that's not using gimmicks and tricks and things that make the law very unpalatable to most Americans.
Gail, we'll have to call time there. Thank you very much for your time.
Great to be with you.
Thank you. Gail Trotter is an attorney and partner in the firm of Schaefer and Trotter. She's a senior fellow at the Independent Women's Forum and a columnist for multiple publications. Her column on this particular case, King versus Burwell, can be found in the Washington Times. I'm Greg Corumbus reporting for Radio America.